Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 18th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Ingrid Christiansson. Today's session number is CHI 2001-03 and it's titled Death and Lesser Losses. Let's listen in.
My name is Ingrid Christiansson and this is the story writing workshop, and today I entitled it Death and Lesser Losses, thinking that it would be an opportunity for us to talk some about that particular thing. But obviously, you would always write what you want to write. Someone has just asked if I would say a few things about myself. I preached on Monday, and I gave a little of my spiritual journey, so I thought that was enough about myself for the week, but I'll say another thing or two. I live in Chicago, and I have taught in an urban studies program for 31 years. And that was an immersion program where college students from St. Olaf and Carleton and McAllister and Lawrence and Grinnell and schools like that came to Chicago for a semester, and it was experiential. So I got to spend 31 years taking wonderful college students around the city to experience firsthand what the city had to teach. I mainly taught public policy and women's studies. And in women's studies, I always, without exception, began my classes by bringing my young students to the home of the Magruder family, who is a family that we're very close to, who have been on public aid for 5 generations now. And Lucille Magruder, who is a dear friend of mine and has been for 35 years, who's the matriarch and who's now 70, would always gather some of her, if we were doing women and health or women and work or something, she would gather some of her daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters, and my students would sit and listen to their stories about whatever the subject was. So, and then I often would take them to visit with prostitutes, because if you're doing health, for example, if you ask a few street women, tell us your health events for the last 2 years, what happened to you, how did you seek help, what kind of help was available, the stories are rich. And then we would go to the institutions that they talked about, where they'd been turned away or where they'd not been treated because of their profession or something, and hear the story of the institution with different ears, because we'd heard the story first from people who'd gone there with great need. So I had a very lovely, lovely, privileged work life, and I also have a husband whom I adore and 2 wonderful young adult children, one of whom is in the kitchen now cooking. And they have come to Holden every summer of their lives, and they find Holden to be a great gift. Anyhow, I quit my job at Christmas time this past year. The time had come to get out of there. I'd been director for a long time, and a new director came, and he was threatened by me, and I'm too bossy, and you know, so I needed to leave. So now I have a new wonderful job, which is being what they call a mitigation specialist for clients who are on death row or who are awaiting trial in a case for which the state has asked them the death penalty. And a mitigation specialist is a person who explores the life and background of such a person and tells the story of their life to the jury by calling witnesses and developing a theme and doing storytelling to a jury in a way that we hope will persuade the jury not to give them the death penalty, or if it's an appeals case, to change the death sentence to maybe life in prison or something. So I spend a lot of time in jail, in prison, interviewing people. My clients I see about once a week for a long interview, and then I follow up on all the leads that they've given me. I call their old grammar school teachers, and I call their cousins, and I call, you know, all the characters of their lives and get the stories from them, and then I come back and check the stories out with my client. And I talk to the lawyer, and then we develop a theory of where we're going with this case. So it's, again, my first job was storytelling, you know, the stories of the city to my students, and my second job is storytelling the stories of my clients to the jury. So you can tell that I love story, and I'm a lucky person to get to do what I love to do. So that's probably much more than you wanted to know about me.
Thank you very much.
No. I also am the president of the board of Genesis House, which is the organization that serves women in prostitution that is visiting us here this week. And that work is volunteer work, but it gives me a great deal of pleasure. And I mostly enjoy the time I can spend with the women that we serve there. I'm going to start this session today by reminding us all of God's promise about death that is my favorite promise from God, and it's one that always, I'm afraid, makes me cry, so I'll have to struggle with that, but I did bring napkins, so if any of you have to cry today, that you certainly are allowed. This is one that my father is a musician, and he's written music to it several times and performed it, especially at Christmas concerts at Concordia and Morehead, So I hear my father's music when I hear the words too, and my father's dead now, so that's another layer of meaning. As in all stories, there are many layers of meaning. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem. It's a beautiful vision we have of the future, you know, of heaven. I saw a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as bride adorned for her husband, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the tabernacle of God is among mortals. God will dwell with them as their God, and they will be God's people, and God himself will be with them. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." So with that promise in mind, I'm going to ask us to do storytelling about death. One of the reasons to do storytelling about death is that we need to tell each other stories about death. Our culture is so afraid of death. We're so resistant to talking about it. We think that after 3 weeks, the family should be over it. And we don't want to see any more signs of grief and of mourning. And we don't know how to do ritual around death. We keep being told, pay someone to do this. Hire a professional. Don't look at the realities. Jewish people have a wonderful process of preparing the body of the dead that includes cleaning onto their fingernails. And I just find that so important to say, this is my person, this is my dead person. But no, we're not. That's not where we are as a culture. So what we can do as Christians is hold each other's hands and go through some talk about death. We can share some stories, we can learn from each other, and we can reclaim our feelings in this area and not be such sort of repressed and sick people about it. I'm going to tell you about my father's death. My father, who was a magnificent, lovely man, died when he was 82. He had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he said, "There's no reason not to do the things you love the most as you're dying." And so what he did were three kinds of things. He was a musician, so he spent every morning working at the piano, composing. And his last work was dated, he died on December 5th, and the work was dated December 1997. So it was within 4 days of his death. The second thing he loved was tennis. And with Lou Gehrig's disease, the muscles that were the most paralyzed for him were his back. So he had to walk like this. He was a very erect and proud man. He walked like this. And so every day or every other day, he would put tennis balls in his pocket, and he would take the racket, and he would spend 10 minutes going from the house to the garage, working his way, short of breath, his lungs were getting paralyzed. But he would get to the car, drive to the tennis courts, get out of the car, spend a half an hour going from the parking lot there to the bang board at the back of the tennis courts in Fargo Island Park, He knew the resting spots along the way to get to the bang board, so he would stop and hold onto a tree limb or something. And then he would drop down, get his ball out, and he had very strong arms to the end. And he could maybe have enough breath for four of these. He'd go, wah, 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 wah. And then he'd rest for a while, and then he'd do four more, and then four more, and then he'd get back in the car, because he loved doing it. And the third thing that he loved to do was tell us all how much he loved us. And so he would tell us all how much he loved us constantly. He would pick up the phone, he would talk to us. We would come home frequently. One afternoon I was home from Chicago to Moorhead, Minnesota, and he said, tell me the story of your life, because I'm afraid I've forgotten parts and I want to remember it all. So we spent the whole afternoon, the two of us, just in a love fest and crying and carrying on. And he kept telling me how proud he was of me. It was such a gift. So that was the way toward death. And then on the day that he died, I won't go through all of the story, but he died at home in his bed, and we kept him there. And we all flew in from all over, you know, gathering in. He wrote Christmas concerts, and this was the first day of Christmas concert weekend at Concordia and Moorhead. And so it was sort of important in that way. But my siblings and I came home, and we just got on the bed where his body was lying. And my mother and my siblings, and then some grandchildren, and a sister, and my father's sister, many people just were in the bedroom hanging around for the whole day and evening. And we had several prayers. Then finally, at midnight or so, we decided that the funeral company could come and take him away. And we had a ritual of prayer and blessing and reading of a psalm before he was carried out of the house. The funeral company couldn't get their gurney around the U-turn at the top of the stairs. And my brothers said, he's our dad, we can handle him. And they picked him up and carried him down the stairs. And mother said to me at one point, Ingrid, would you take off his watch? And as I was taking off his watch, I remembered when he had first put a watch on me as a Christmas present when I was a child. And, you know, that memory would never have come to me if I hadn't taken off his watch. So there were so many dear things. And then the funeral company said, what are you going to send clothes, you know? So then we had this wonderful conversation with all these people about what clothes to send. In the midst of doing things like he was wearing his red plaid boxer shorts, and we were doing things like admiring his muscles and saying, I want to look at his feet again. And, you know, we had access to his body. So we debated. He owned 5 tuxedos, and we thought about his various tuxedos. And then we thought about his suits, and we thought about his jackets, his informal jackets. We thought about his tennis clothes. And finally we said, in the funeral home, he was not going to be on public display. He was going to be on access by family only for one more day, and then he was going to be cremated. So finally we decided his red plaid boxer shorts. And the funeral company was a little bit appalled, I have to say. But hey, he's our dad, you know? And so we just had a blanket that, you know, when people who hadn't been able to get there the first day could get there the second day, they wanted to admire his muscles one more time or see his certain toe or something. He was available. It wasn't scary. It was just our dad. And then at the end of the second day, we had a blessing and the committal service, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. And during the blessing, we did the committal service because he was going to be cremated, and we wanted to reassure ourselves that we were doing the right thing, that it felt like he was entering into a stream of our culture, our history, our practice as Christians, that cremating him was not a violation, but it was somehow part of who we were as a people. That was a bigger thing than just us. And the blessing that we did was everyone got to call him by their name. So I got to say, Daddy, may the Lord bless you and keep you. Daddy, may he make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. My mother was saying, Paul, may the Lord bless you and keep you. You know, everybody got their name, PJ, whatever they called him. And so that grandpa. And so that we all felt like we held his hand on each side. Somebody had his hand and we were in a circle, maybe 50 relatives by then. But we felt like we were connected to him and we were blessing him on his way. And then we left, I thought, when we left the funeral home, I was going to be devastated. At the end of the second day, I would not have access to that body anymore. But at that point, his spirit left. He was a very physical man. He was very embodied. He danced. But his spirit then departed, and I felt okay about walking out of the room. And we all did. There was no great kerfuffle. And so that's one model of something. And it was totally feeling our way. It was not something that we knew how to do. It was just saying, this is what we need for our family at this time. So that's why I think it's important to tell these stories. I don't think you need to be told how to tell a story. I think you know when it begins. You know what the content, what the details, what the images, what the smells, the sights, the sounds of it are. And I think you know when you're finished. So I'm not going to tell you any of that. I'm going to read you a few bits that other people have done about death. And some of these bits might be useful to you in terms of thinking of an opening line or a way to get your page going. Some of them, you're welcome to use any part of any of these things that you think are helpful. This, I'm just going to read you the first couple lines. It's called Partial Clearance. And you know, if you've experienced death, that this poet has got much more to come. But at this point, 1 week, this poet says, barely a week later, I'd return to myself again. But where a light perspective of particulars used to range under an accommodating blue sky, there were only numb mind tones, thoughts clenched like little fists, and symbols struggling to release their sense to my imagination. I tried to get out of myself, but it was like emerging into a maze. The building across the street still looked the same, but they seemed foreshortened, dense, and much closer than I'd realized, as though I'd only seen them previously in a dream. So that line, barely a week later, I'd returned to myself again. Now you know the person has not returned to herself again, or he is himself after a week, but I mean, a year later, you still haven't returned to yourself, or 2 years later, you're never the same. Here's a story by my friend Eunice Scarf, and I'm going to read you the opening and the end paragraphs. It's about a little boy losing his father and his memories of that as an adult, the story of his father's death. Say on that day, it's called The 5 o'clock Train by Eunice Scarf. Say on that day, you were awakened by a calm, low whistle of the morning's London train. The London train? Surely it can't be that late. Where's your mother? Why hadn't she called you by now? If it weren't so dark and cold, you would run to the window and check the steam engine's number and gauge, count the cars, copy down the numbers in your brand new train spotting book. But the night is not yet broken. You stay in bed, listening to the last soft clatter of the train's busy wheels. Is this a holiday? You have forgotten? Is it half term, a Saturday? No, it must be a school day. There's your navy jacket hanging on the hook behind the door, its sleeves permanently bent at the elbow. So this child knows, begins the day, his memory of the day his father died is, something's wrong here. Why aren't I up already? Where's my mother? And it ends, quickly, quickly now, run to meet the bus, run to meet your dad. Never should have stopped to spot the train, never should have left the safety of the lane. Run, hurry, never mind the water in your shoes, dampness soaking down your tired back. Run, the bus stop, the watered bench, wait for father riding on the double-decker bus. Hear the tinkle of the old conductor's bell, watch the red bus shove around the bend, see the bright lights beaming through the steam deck windows. Father, come. Father, hurry. Father, I have come to walk you home to tea. Father, hurry. I am waiting. Father, come. I am here. And of course, the father won't come. But the kind of franticness as the child is realizing more and more that something is desperately wrong, his father wasn't coming. Here's a lovely, lovely piece written by Sharon Olds, which is a piece about a child's death when she was a child. It's called Best Friends. And of course, it's dedicated to her best friend, who lived from 1942 to 1951. The day my daughter turned 10, the day my daughter turned 10, so this is an adult woman writing, I thought of the lank, glittering, greenish cap of your gold hair. The last week of your life, when I came each day after school, I'd study the path to your front door, the bricks laid close as your hairs. I'd try to read the pattern, frowning down for a sign. The last day, there was not a mark on that walk, not a stone out of place. The nurses would not let me in. We were 9. We had never mentioned death or growing up. I had no more imagined you dead than you imagined me a mother. But when I had a daughter, I named her for you, as if pulling you back through a crack between the bricks. She's 10 now, Liddy. She has outlived you, her dark hair gleaming like the earth into which the path was pressed, the path to you. So you can do that too, you know. Those touchstones and things that remind you and triggers. When her daughter turned 10 and she realized that Liddy died when she was 9. She'd lost her best friend as a child, and that kind of the grown-ups not handling that. I have to stop this, but I've got a few lines here. Writing about the dead by Sandra Nichols. When is it safe to write about the dead? You have to make them welcome at first. They're new at this and insecure. You might draw up a chair, pull out the albums. You can even cry a little if you want. They go all soft at the sound of tears. They forget their shyness and stop by. You can comfort them with the quiet scribbling of pens, the rustle of paper hunched over your desk at 3 a.m., a time they particularly like. Feel their hands on your shoulders. You expect them to be cold, but they're warm. They stay quiet until the last page. Just when you think you've got them right, they whisper in your ear, was that how it really was? They laugh about the doubts they've planted in your head. You should hear the din when the dead get together. Did you see the look on her face? They chortle until the tears come running down. And then they tell each other how it was, for they never tire of the stories, and they don't give a damn about accuracy. They only ask to comfort themselves, hoping they won't be forgotten. So there's a little cheerleading about writing about the dead. And here's one that I wrote at one point, 16 thoughts about death and grief. And this is a nice method of doing it. Number one, what Anne said about Musée des Beaux-Arts, how life goes on when everything should have stopped. Icarus falls from the sky, and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In a sense, it is like an endless birthday when someone who might have remembered does not realize or remember that it is your birthday. Perhaps they even say lovely things to you, but not the right things. The punchline is wrong, and you constantly feel cheated and hurt. It wears you down. Number two. Then sometimes they act surprised that you are still doing that. You're still grieving. Number three, sometimes you are not still grieving. Number four, sometimes you cannot move and barely have enough metal to get through the next act, like brushing your teeth or teaching a class or getting gas in the car or even calling your grieving mother. Number 5. You cannot sing the hard hymns in church or even run the stiff pepper grinder because it is not worth the effort and your energy is focused elsewhere. Number 6. Fear is lurking in the shadows. Who will be next? Will you be able to bear it when that one comes? Can you hold up for one more? What if it is one of your children or your husband? What if Sigurd dies? Number 7. There, now you have said even that. Number 8. Sometimes you are okay, fine even, laughing. Number 9. You are an imposter, only grieving when others do, when you feel the sympathy of others, only when it happens in reflection. Yourself, you do not actually have deep feelings. Number 10. Or faith enough. You do not actually down deep believe those things that your religion says about death and afterlife. You do not know what death is, only you know that you don't like it. Number 11. Your only comfort is your faith and conviction of the everlastingness of the spirit. Number 12. At any moment you are suddenly sobbing. A hiccup can turn into racking sobs. The least thing releases something. You are like someone who is incontinent. You have incontinent tears. Number 13. Rituals surrounding death, from the most secular to the most religious, especially ancient and rooted ones, have tremendous appeal. They pull you with a strong force and feel important and true. Number 14. Our cultural ways of dealing with the facts of dying and the facts of the dead seem harmful. You intuitively reject them. There have to be better ways. Number 15. You want to wear a shroud, to join with other women, to care for the dead closely and attentively. Then you want to wail, to keen, to find expression for this grief which is eating you from the inside out. Number 16. You want to wear the shroud until you are ready not to, and then to wear it again if you wish, with no questions asked, no second guessing. You don't want to have to say which of your dead you are grieving and why now, and if it is only one or more, and if you are grieving the fact of your own death, the death of your children, and the death of your yet unborn grandchildren, and the death of the earth. So that is a method of numbering the things you want to say, and just going through it in a kind of, as they come to you, each thing. Give each one a number. So with those little stimuli, you now have a blank page facing you. And we'll come back in about 12 minutes. There's some paper here. All right, let's come back together. I'd sort of like the will of the group. What I will do without you, unless you say something else, is maybe have two people read to all of us so we get sort of the model of how it goes. I have rules for reading, which I'll review for us, and then form into small groups so everyone can read in a small group. Unless we want to spend more time or come back this afternoon, and then we could all read in the big group. We probably will have the feedback, the comments back will be, I would say, should be pretty short today, abbreviated. We probably won't have many of those. But any comments that do come back are these two sets of comments I want to know more about, and then you say what you want to know about. Or I liked how you said, and I would like you to say the specific words. Don't elaborate about them, don't learn why you liked them. Just reflect the words back. So it's good to write the words down when you're listening so that you hear the exact words or phrase that you like or the single word you like. So we don't say why you liked the word, but you just say it. Just so that we have a short, what the writer needs to hear is that the writer's words were honored and valued. Tears are good and should be respected and honored, but not fussed over. Tears are allowed, they're welcome, but we don't need to be a, you know, yeah. And there's no responding by any other method, for example, no responding by telling a story to a story. You can't tell your own story in response to someone's story. If you want to do your story, you write it down and read it. Today, this is about honoring the words on the page. So those are the guidelines. Should we do that and have a couple of people read out loud and hear the stories and then go into small groups? Or would you like to try to get as many heard in the whole group as we could? Let's do the small groups. You could do small groups of approximately four. That way you can all hear. So who would like to read to the big group? Yes, please. Carol, is it?
This is about my mother. I remember looking at you as you laid in your pine coffin. It had been beautifully made by a carpenter to put in. You didn't want a fancy, expensive coffin and told the boys to put that money towards the tennis court. You were so prepared for your death, your lovely dress from El Salvador. That had been your last teaching job, your hair nicely done like you were telling us. Of course, this is part of God's plan and God will take care of me. You even got back to Montana from El Salvador, even though you were so ill with cancer. You were always so strong and self-reliant and taking care of yourself. Your bloating and yellowish color when you got off the plane. You blamed on some sausages you fixed before you left that didn't agree with you when you added sauerkraut to them the next time you ate them. But I think as much as you loved and embraced life, you were ready to go. You had told me at Christmas when we were having coffee at Mayfair how you always loved to go out to places like that where there were people. How much you miss Daddy and male companionship. You never wanted to be a burden to any of us, but how much I wish you would have shared with us some of your feelings on how hard it was when Dad died, how rough it was, so we could have supported you more. But that wasn't your way. But Mother, I want you to know how much I love you and I'm so thankful I had you for my mom and how proud I am of you.
Thank you, Carol. Did anyone write down any words that she said? I know it's hard when you get so carried away listening. You don't want to write them down, but Elizabeth, did you get something?
Yeah, I liked, I don't know the exact words, but the El Salvador dress, which came from her last teaching job.
Mm-hmm. And her hair made perfectly made the way she liked it.
I love the part about blaming her color on the sausage.
I wish I had known her mom.
So you want to know more about her? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How interesting a life.
I like the words at the beginning about how she wanted the money to go to the tennis court.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Carol, for reading that. You should probably do some more writing there. Someone else? Why don't you go next?
There was never a question that Hollis loved his family. He was a gentle spirit, a tall, gentle man, who had thoughtful blue eyes, who smiled through you. He walked with the grace of God in his step. He loved and loved deeply. There was a passion for the river and for the flow of life. There was a passion for family, work, church, and community. He was an artist of life and love and spirit. There was never a question Hollis loved his grandson. A boy should not grow up without a dad, he said. And Granddad saw that he did not. The miles in the car to see Jack confirmed, excitement in his step on his way to the games, the light in his eyes when they brought home the day's catch. My son is growing up now with smiling blue eyes and a gentle, kind spirit.
Thank you. What is your name?
Pardon me?
What is your name?
Joanne.
Joanne. Thank you, Joanne. Words back for Joanne?
I like when she says, he smiled through you. I like that. He smiled through you.
I had the exact same part. And also, I liked how you waited till the end to reveal that he was your father. But I didn't guess that till the end, and it just tied it all together.
Mm-hmm. I like the way the smiling thing came through, too. She said, the eye, that was smiling eyes, are upturned eyes. And then she also brought that out again in the latter part of the story about the smile. The smile.
Yeah, I like the reflect, there was never a question. There was never a question used repetitively, too.
I like the way she said, or you said, that there was a passion for the river and the flow of love.
Another beautiful piece, thank you. What's your name?
My name's Michael.
Michael, why don't you read to us?
I knew it was getting closer to your death when you didn't want to sit outside in the sun and fresh air. The day before, you had looked so wonderful in your wide-brimmed straw gardener's hat, your shaded face creased with the knowledge of shortening time. Then you would sleep in a chair. Later you would sleep in a chair next to me because it was more comfortable. And tap my sleeping shoulder in the middle of the night. You needed me to hold the little stainless steel kidney-shaped pan so you could puke up dark waste from your insides. The cancer that the doctors had looked at a year before was squeezing you. I cleaned you up and gave you water. During the day, you even helped me do crosswords. With your eyes shut, you could find a five-letter word for me. I must have been mad, I thought to myself, asking my dying mother for help doing crosswords. In the early a.m. of Thanksgiving morning, you woke with words. You were in your bed now, with a catheter. I was holding your hand. You said you could go now. I said it was fine. You had gathered us all together. It was Thanksgiving. Our family holiday of being together.
Words back.
I like how he said she could give you a five-letter word with her eyes closed.
I thought it was nice that you spoke to your mother in your writing.
I liked you said you could go now, and I said it was fine. And the rhythm of those sentences at the end, they're short, one short sentence after another, and it was, I know I'm talking too much, but it's slowing it down and it's bringing it to the end. It was very effective to use those short sentences, each one slower than the next. The kind of inevitability of it. Elizabeth.
I liked at the beginning there, the hat and that her face was creased with the decreasing time. Very good.
Yeah.
I liked how at the end you revealed it was Thanksgiving, and how that was your family holiday. That was really helpful. Okay.
Thank you. I should write some more about it. Well, I hate to not hear every single story. My ears feel cheated already. But I think for you all to be able to read, we need to get you in groups of four or so. So I recommend that you form yourselves into clusters and read to one another, and I'll come from cluster to cluster and listen in.
Can I pass?
You certainly don't. Nobody has to read. Nobody has to read. Absolutely. I'm sorry. I should have said that loud and clear.